Hi there, welcome along to the High Performance Podcast. We have had over the past 12 months so many people just telling us that they want more. They want more from this podcast. So this is why things look slightly different for this new series. Not just on a Monday, every Monday, but also on Wednesdays, you could expect episodes to suddenly appear from the High Performance Podcast just to help you out if you need a little bit of inspiration. Don't forget, you can also find us on Instagram at High Performance or on YouTube as well. But let's get to it. It's time for the latest High Performance Podcast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hello there, I'm Jake Humphrey. You're listening to High Performance, the podcast that delves into the minds of the most successful athletes, visionaries, entrepreneurs, and artists on the planet. Aim is to unlock the very secrets to their high performance life so you can follow in their footsteps. With me as ever, lecturer, author, professor Damien Hughes. And Damien, from a rural tea plantation in India to the most cutting edge sporting series on the planet. I think today's going to be quite a story.
I think it's going to be fascinating. I think that this is somebody that, having read about him, talks about one of his great skills is being an observer and a watcher. And I'm interested in going from different worlds. What is it he watches for?
Interesting. Let's find out. And let's delve into the tricks, the behaviours, the mindsets and the belief that is required to work in industries as diverse as tea, IT, wind turbines, all the way to being the CEO and team principal of the Mahindra Formula E team. Now, how has our guest married personal success with inspiring a team, competing on a global sporting stage, but at the same time keeping human emotion at the heart of his journey? And if you watch coverage of Formula E, you will know that this man is very emotional in the back of the garage during every race. Welcome to the High Performance Podcast, Dilbag Gill. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks, guys, for having me here.
Let's start with the question we ask all our guests at the very beginning. What is high performance?
For me, I would look at high performance as consistency. Consistency of conviction, consistency of belief, consistency of influence, consistency of courage, consistency of boldness. So I would say, like, it's all, like, if you can be sort of really strong on what you're trying to do and do it on a daily basis, that, for me, that's high performance.
So where did that mindset come from then for you to not just look for excellence, but to do it consistently?
So I go back to one of my earlier jobs. And I still remember, like, my boss telling me, do it right the first time. And I think that sort of stuck with my all the time. Like, because see, when I grew up in India, labor was cheap. So therefore, rework was cheap. So a lot of time, we just did a patch job and said, okay, yeah, man, if this job needs to be redone, we'll redo it. But this boss man said, do it right the first time around. And for me, I think that sort of struck a chord. Let's try and do stuff. Let's take pride and pleasure in what we do. And do it right.
And what was the job that you were doing when you got that advice?
I was head of marketing of a telecom company at that point in time. And I don't know what the context was. It wasn't directly related to my job. He was just giving a blanket statement on something. But that struck a chord. And I think, yeah, that's what, like 22 years ago or something like that. So it's been pretty early in my career when I heard that, and it sort of stuck with me.
And you were born into a family where you grew up on a tea plantation, so your dad was already a businessman. I know that you went to boarding school at only 5 years old, and I did a little bit of research into that, and I saw that the motto for the school was never give in. So I wonder whether you were getting these kinds of messages about trying to achieve a high-performance life from really quite a young age, were you?
To be honest, no. I think for me, the transformation in my life was when I started working. I think I was really laid back, took life really easily while growing up. I was quite lucky because I grew up, I won't say a privileged life, but in a reasonably comfortable life. Okay, so we did have everything what we needed. At the same time, we did not have a lot of stuff which was needed also. Like, I grew up on this real rural area, so we did not have television, we did not have telephones. We had to interact with humans. Because that was the only form of thing. Okay, the maximum was a radio.
Wow.
And the newspaper, which used to come up by the first bus around 11 o'clock in the morning, the bus came up. So a lot of my work was just like walking around the plantation, working with the people out there. And that industry is very labor intense because tea is very rural, very labor intense. And there was, I remember, a strike, a labor strike at one point in time. There was some dispute. And my dad said, we need to get produce from the field to the factory. Someone needs to drive the truck. I volunteered at 13. And I said, that's the best job I could get in my vacation was driving a truck with produce. But then that also gave me a sense of responsibility because I needed to get stuff from A to B right while I was doing something reasonably illegal, okay, because I didn't have a driving license and I should not be driving a truck, but it was private road, so we could get away with it. And I think when now it's been 35 years, so I don't think I can get into trouble with that.
No, I think you're okay. Yeah. I think you're okay.
So that's where I think responsibility sort of came. My dad just sort of trusted me. He said, you're going to do this.
When you say that the moment came from being in work, what was it that gave you? What was the emotion you got from finally being at work that impacted you more than perhaps schoolwork? Because we hear this from a lot of our guests that school didn't really resonate with them. They didn't really tune into it. It was the world of work that opened their eyes to what can be achieved.
See, while I was a student, I was an average student. I could get by. Like, I knew I could do the minimum to get by. And I always worked to the minimum. When I started work, I realized, man, now it is a world where you have to prove you're not going to be coasting any longer. It's not automatic, okay, that this year in seventh grade, you're going next year to eighth grade, and then the year after that to ninth. If you want to move up, you need to start showing some leadership, taking some risk, doing something which is different. And I think that's where I really started pushing myself. And also at that point in time, I realized that I didn't take too much out of my education. So I said, okay, maybe I'll be better as a general person, like learning different disciplines rather than just focusing on trying to be an engineer, which I'd studied because I was a hopeless engineer.
So one of the key attributes that I've read that you described a lot of your success has been one, doing it right first time, but another one is questioning everything. So when did that curiosity then start to ignite, to start challenging and questioning and trying to understand?
I would say this was somewhere when I was like 18, 19 years old. I went out to university and this is the first time I've been to a city because I grew up in this rural area, as I said. My dad sort of said, okay, this is the money you're going to have for the first year of college. And this is the first time I had access to a bank account because they opened a bank account at university, deposited money. And said, okay, how much do you estimate? So we did an estimate. I think it was like X amount of rupees per month. So he said, okay, for the next 6 months, this is what you need. There's the money in the bank. Off I go. And he went home. And this was a city. And this is the city of Bangalore, which is known for its pubs in Bangalore. Okay, like with the beer, etc. So second day in university, we went out to have a drink. The third day we went out. And then I realized, I think in a month and a half, that I've spent the 6 months of money already. I cannot call up home because we don't have telephones at home. So I have to write a letter. And at that point in time, I can't be eating food, etc., because I didn't have any money. So that's when I decided that, okay, I need to sort of survive. My dad replied to me, says, too bad. You estimated for 6 months. Figure it out yourself. So what I decided then was, the only way for me to survive is to start repairing motorcycles in the hostel of the college. So I started repairing motorcycles, and I started making money there. And that's how I got into motorsport to a certain extent. I said, okay, I was pretty good at working with my hands. So in year one, I started repairing motorcycles. And by year two, I hired two people who lived off campus, but he used to come into the campus during the day to strip the bikes down. So by the evening when I finished class, I could come and work on it. So they knew how to wash the bike, service it. So then thereafter what happened was every evening, like that became sort of a social point, the garage, that corner where we used to repair motorcycles. And people used to either pay me with cash, beer or cigarettes. So it was like whatever they had, they like this repair.
You weren't fussy. You'd take it.
We'd just take it. And then I started realizing, okay, we started doing a little bit of racing on a motorcycle. I started doing that. And I suddenly realized that the college campus like started supporting me. They said, okay, this guy is going out trying to do racing, etc. So we didn't have much money. So someone, and I knew every motorcycle in our college. We had like 2,000 odd motorcycles there. This guy had the best tires. That guy had the best suspension. So we used to borrow parts from everyone. And they used to all give it, okay, here, you use it and then bring it back. And petrol also, steal petrol from everyone, like from the fill up your tank and go out. And I think that's when it sort of came back that if you take something on, there are people who are going to support you. And I still remember when I finished college, I was earning a princely sum of money. Like I did save a lot of money when I finished college. I went to dad and said, here, you take your money back. I'm giving you back money with interest.
What was his reaction to that?
He took it and he said, yeah, son, let's have a drink tonight. And he bought it. So it was like, he was pretty clear. He was actually proud of it, I think. In the end of the day, he says, okay, he wasn't proud of my score because I really didn't focus too much on my education part of it. But he was happy that, okay, I survived. I sort of managed on my own. I didn't bother him too much on stuff. And I still remember, I think it took me like 5 years of real working to reach sort of the money I was making when I was a student.
Wow.
So when I started work, it wasn't as much money. So I started my first job with cash in pocket. So it was really nice.
But you had to be someone that was willing to forge your own path. Because I think growing up in India, Indian families are very, very keen on an education and a strong education and going into your chosen field. Whereas it almost feels to me like you'd made that decision at college that of course you were going to be at college and you would get the grades. But the key for you was the work outside of that. So at this point, do you feel that you'd become an entrepreneur?
I think, yes, I did become an entrepreneur because I knew I'd done my engineering course, but I'm not going to be a very good engineer. So I need to survive. And talking about education, as you rightly say, in India, we take it really seriously. So I have two siblings, an elder sister and a younger brother. So my sister was a doctor. I'm an engineer and my brother's a lawyer. So we sort of did the three tick boxes for my parents. They were happy.
What you've done subsequently is, looking at your career is, although you applied convention in many ways to that traditional Indian holy trinity of law, medical and engineering, your career since has been quite unconventional when we look at it, that you've gone across quite a wide variety from selling tea on the internet to working with wind turbines, IT, and now into motorsport. How do you establish credibility in each of those worlds when you first enter them?
Oh, that's a nice question. I really don't know if I ever looked at credibility and think, because, okay, I took an opportunity, I found it exciting, and I said, let's go do our best. And as you said, like I've always changed industry and function. I went from marketing to manufacturing and stuff like that. I think I'm reasonably comfortable knowing I don't know what I don't know.
That in itself is a very important mindset, because I think a lot of people are not brave enough to admit there are things they don't know, are they? People like to pretend they know everything. They think it makes them seem stronger or more powerful.
I don't know about that, because for myself, I'm absolutely sure. Yeah. I know I'm not the smartest guy in the room, and I don't want to be the smartest guy in the room. But at the same time, I would love to work with like-minded people to get stuff done. So it's for us, whenever I take up something, I've never looked at it as a job. And maybe that's where this thing comes in. I look at it as a mission. Okay, this is something which I need to do. We have to do. So a lot of stuff which I've done is like jumping into new bits. And some of it was like totally new for even our country. And that's what challenged me, I think. Like wind turbines just came to India. Let me be one of the first employees for a wind turbine company. I think this is going to be something exciting. I never looked at it from a sustainability perspective, nothing. It was just, it's a new industry. No one knows anything. It's sort of a flat playing field for all of us. Let's go do it. Another thing which struck me is that find the purpose, the means will follow. Like once you know where you're going to, things start falling in place, because I think it's all your focus goes around that.
So what would you say your purpose was? Because you spoke about this idea of having a powerful drive and a mission. What's yours?
I think the purpose changes with time. So there's not been like one single purpose like with each thing. But I think of recent, which sort of drives me a lot, is I sort of take it to a small extent that I'm carrying India. I want to carry India. Like, don't want to embarrass India at different stuff. So even when I needed the World Cup, which was, I think, a much more challenging sort of job than what we're doing right now at Formula E, I remember growing up watching athletes, and we never ever believed that we'll ever get out of where we are. And I've always been a fan of human talent.
So when you're building teams, and you've built teams across all kinds of different industries, you've now created a Formula E team who've won races, and every single season they've competed in Formula E right from the very beginning of the sport. What do you look for in people? What is the talent that you want in the teams that are around you? What do you think are the key attributes?
I think first is trying to find out, break down what the problem you're trying to solve. Okay, and what's the person's commitment to the problem? For me, I think commitment to something is really important. So I'm looking for people to a certain extent who are like me. 9 to 5 doesn't exist in our diary. Like, we are, like, if we have to be, we are going to be called together to do something on a Saturday morning and work for 6 straight days. Is this person going to be? I look at people, okay, saying, if I'm going for a war, who do I want to be on my side on the battle? Like, who can I depend on?
I love that. That's something that I've read is a big message that Sir Alex Ferguson used to use at Manchester United, that he used to encourage his players to look on either side of them in the dressing room and appreciate what they brought to the battle with them and why they were glad that they were alongside them. I really like that as a question to ask.
There'll be lots of people listening to this who are running teams, running businesses, and they would love to have people around them who would go to war with them. How do you get the right people in the room, though? What are the questions you ask or the processes that you go through to make sure the people in your team will go to war?
I'm not sure if it comes out through a question, at least. I think now, with a little bit of experience, is instinct.
Yeah.
You just look at a person, you start talking. And to be honest, you sometimes, if you do an interview, you sort of make your decision the first 10, 15 seconds. After that, it's, I think you're just trying to validate your own decision which you've made.
Sure, but that intrigues me because you're an engineer by training. So you're somebody that uses logic and precision. So it intrigues me that you talk about intuition as much as logic in your decisions.
But isn't intuition a part of logic? Like, with logic, with experience becomes intuition? Because, like, after some time you experience the same thing again and again. It's instinct after that, you know, okay, I'm going to protect myself from this situation because...
Sure, but I think what Jake's trying to ask is, what is it that somebody listening to this can tap in and learn from your logic that they can use to accelerate their own decision-making?
I think from my side, like, the first sort of, where we sort of break the ice on the first question is, ask the person to talk about his personal, what does he sort of believe, and nothing to do with the job, nothing to do with that, like... Let's take a break the ice question. I think that's where you start hearing and learning, okay, what sort of tries to drive this individual. Because, yes, for a job on the technical side, a person can read the books and he can come in and he can give you all the brilliant answers. And I think this also goes back to a little bit to myself, because I was never a good student. So I was never too sure that if I go for an interview, I'll be able to answer the technical stuff. So maybe I tried talking about stuff which is not technical and go, because I was not very comfortable. And maybe that's something which I look for in the other individual is, okay, is this person like, who, then, like I said, go for a walk, have a beer in the evening with this person. Like,
so what's the first question you'd ask me then? If I was applying to come and join your team?
First question I'll ask you is that, if you were in my position, what would you do? So that gives me an idea if the guy's thought about the company. Does he feel there's a future of this organization? Does he have a vision where it should be heading to? So I basically say, okay, you're me. What would you do?
And do you want the answer to be in line with what you would do? Or do you want them to challenge your thinking?
I would like them to challenge my thinking. Because end of the day, as you've seen in my career, I've taken up new roles. I don't know that industry. I don't know the job. So I'm looking for people who know a bit more to take this forward. Many times I'm riding the wave of the people who have done the hard work below me or with me. So I think at some point in time, I don't know if I've really been lucky all my life that I've had teams who have sort of carried me. And many times I do question myself, am I a person who should have been the leader?
See, I'm very interested that you talk about questioning whether you are really a leader or whether you're just lucky. And we talk a lot on this podcast about evidence. People constantly look for evidence. The evidence is you haven't just been, if you're lucky, you get lucky once, maybe you get lucky twice, but you've been relentlessly successful in all kinds of different industries throughout your career. So it can't be luck, can it? You're being modest. Like, you can't constantly be successful and constantly be lucky. The luck would run out.
Again, it depends on the definition of success, right? And for me, I think when I look at success out here, it's how to achieve success in terms of uplifting, motivating, taking the whole spirit up and about. And I said, this goes back again to the roots where we started from, of India. And that's something which I really identify with the company which I work for, because our tagline is RISE. And that word means a lot to me.
How do you achieve that in a team where you have two individual drivers looking for their own personal success, and then you have a wider team looking for team success, and then you're having to please your sponsors, and you're having to work with the media? How do you think you create an environment to help people rise?
I think for us, what we've tried to do differently is, again, we questioned everything on motorsport when it came in. Okay, for us, because we've never done motorsport, so there was nothing called convention. Okay, this is how it's always been done. I didn't know that. And when I heard it, that statement irritated me. Okay, when people come and tell you, but this is how we always do it. Like, no, question everything. Okay, the 5 W's. Just go through that, like everything has to be, because once you've gone through the 5 W's, okay, you've to a certain extent drilled down to it. Like, so why, what, where, when, who? Okay, so you sort of go, I don't know whichever order it is in, but you go through the 5 W's, you have drilled it down, the problem, to the basics. Okay? And then, once you start questioning everything, we sort of looked at it slightly differently. And I think from our side, we realized, okay, we are going to have an organization which is still going to be like a family. And that's how Mahindra Racing has sort of grown. Like, we know each other. We are like, so as a team also, we need people who are going to work for each other. Like, oh yes, each driver, when the visor goes down, he's for himself. But I think the philosophy in our organization is this, for the team. And that's how we've had some of our drivers, like even when he had Nick Heidfeld and et cetera, they really understood what our motivation was and started to work towards helping build a team.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Nick there, because I read some interesting comments on him that even after he'd left the team, he spoke about how his relationship with you was still one of trust and understanding. So how do you deal with people that don't demonstrate trust and understanding and buy into this family ethos?
I don't think we would work for too long together. And we've had, I think, one instance of that. So I think we've been, again, using the word luck, over 6 years of this team. Large part of the team has sort of been together since inception. The core group at least has been together since inception. And we sort of still believe and we are quite aligned in the direction we want to go. Nick still helps, advises, for example. So like, he started as an opportunity maybe 5 years ago, and he's now become a part of the Mahindra family. And this all goes back again. We were pretty close to doing a sponsorship deal with Sauber in 2008. So I was a guest of Sauber at the Sao Paulo Grand Prix. Nick was a driver. I met up with him, and I think I was the last guy standing in the autograph line as a guest or whatever it is. So he had some time to talk to me after it. And he was really, really nice at that point in time. I said, man, this guy is a great guy. And yeah, I think what's 5-6 years later, when we had an opportunity, I said, I'm going to knock on this guy's door. It's just that first interaction, when like the way decently he spent time with me, answering my questions, talking to it. So this is a person who I believe will help us grow this team, because he has the level of empathy. He has a technical understanding. He's a brilliant driver.
But it's not an easy thing to create a family culture in a sport as cutthroat and as competitive as motor racing. So coming back to Damien's point about people that aren't right for you, how do you make sure they don't change the culture of your organization? Do you get rid of them quickly? Are you ruthless in that situation?
I think I am. Because at the end of the day, for the greater good. See, we have to be, high performers. At the end of the day, averages can pull you down. And we have to make sure that, yeah, just going by the old analogy, that one rotten apple can sort of dirty the basket. So we have to take care of that. And we take care of it pretty early and soon. So I think at that point in time, there has to be no compromise. Because at the end of the day, we are doing something for the greater good. And for that greater good, people need to get aligned. They need to believe in where we are getting to. But at the same time, when you talk about belief, I would strongly say that we also encourage disagreement.
Do you?
Yes. But at the same time, but disagreement, but commit. That's something which I talk to my leadership team all the time. I said, guys, let's agree to disagree, whatever. But once you make a decision, we're going to commit to it.
That's difficult, though, because for me, there'd always be a small voice in the back of my head going, you didn't want to do this. And not wanting failure, but kind of wanting to be proven right, I think, would be something that would be on my mind. I'd be like, I told them not to do this. Now it's gone wrong. Ha, I told you so. You don't allow that?
But try not to encourage that. And at the same time, see, the group of people which we have who have been together for a reasonably long period of time, okay, none of them are superstars. So now, I think they also believe that, okay, we can come and make something better than what we all sort of came from. And I think that belief still continues within the team. And I think to a large extent, what we try and do at our end, because being a smaller team, is throw them at the deep end. No, we're not going to let you drown. Water's going to reach your nose. You're going to flail for some time, but you will not drown. The team is going to jump in to save you.
So you've used some really fascinating terms there in terms that you've spoken about. The culture you create is one of a family. You speak about this idea of you look for commitment. And yet you're in a world where you also require technical excellence. So how do you stop people developing their own fiefdoms or this silo mentality where people protect their knowledge rather than have this culture of sharing it and being prepared to open themselves up to disagreement? What are the tips that you'd give to anyone listening to this that avoids that?
I think one area which we try and protect from creating fiefdoms and silos is strong communication. So we tend to get together and speak on a very regular basis. So I would say, like, what at Mahindra Racing, we have like a 5-person management committee. So we tend to meet up. If not, we speak every day. There's at least 2 formal calls every week, a Monday and a Friday, the start of the week and the end of the week. So we are literally on the same page what everyone is doing. And the minutes of our conversation is circulated to the entire organization. So what the 5 of us speak is sort of sent out in a document to the entire team later in that morning. So people know what's being discussed, and we try and keep each person with their experience helping the other one around. Then I think we use some of the traditional methods also of rewards also based on team performance, not an individual performance. So the way the compensation rewards and other HR tools are designed is for team performance. Even when I look at drivers, a lot of their bonuses are structured around team performance, not individual performance.
And is that different? So is that an example of you challenging the convention of motorsport?
So for the first 2 years, we had like bonuses for drivers on individual performance. And I said, by third year, man, this doesn't make sense. Why am I incentivizing this person for his performance? Because then we're sort of, each guy is just sort of going out. And if it, there is a bit of a financial, and it's a pretty substantial financial incentive. So it's just not a rounding off number. It's a number which makes a difference for them. From a thing. I said, no, let's do it for team performance. Not only them, but everyone in the team gets.
And were shared. Were the drivers against that initially, do you think?
I think since we had 2 drivers at that point in time who were mature enough to understand the purpose of what we're trying to do, that was Nick and Felix, they said, man, this makes sense. And they signed off onto it immediately. When I did my first organization chart, I had the drivers reporting into me. Okay, because I thought, look, these guys are the stars. By year 3, the drivers report into our team manager. So they also realize that they are employees like everyone else for the rest of the year. They're heroes on the day when they have to perform. That's the day when we expect them to do. But the rest of the year, in terms of when they need to come in, when they have to like work on the simulator, do other stuff, they actually now report to the team manager. When they call up to moan to me, I say, sorry, you need to speak to David on this. It's not me. If you just look at a traditional organization chart and look at every level and think, okay, that's 1 level more junior, they're like, I think, 3rd in this chart. So there's 2 layers above them before they reach out to me.
And if you're not happy with the performance of your drivers, who deals with them then? Is that up to the team manager, or do you step forwards in that situation?
I think we're small enough where each one of us makes our displeasure clear at different points. And I think each of us can get displeased for different reasons. Mm. As you guys know, I do not control, I don't hold back my emotions. I do share it at that point of time. And there are many times I regret, because what you say in anger is the stuff you're going to regret sometime later. But that's something I feel I need to get it off my chest, and I make it clear and I sort of take it out. But at the same time, sometimes people, I think, find it difficult to judge me, because I'll be angry with you in the morning, and by the afternoon, I'm okay. For me, even like when we talk at home with my wife, and we say, let's disagree on that point and not carry the fight everywhere else. Like, okay, this is something we're going to be fighting on. Yeah. But the rest of it, we still like each other on, or something like that. So like, let's, when we have a disagreement in work also, it's, please try and keep it to that point. Let's bifurcate disagree and dislike. I think that's a nutshell for success, is if you disagree, but you don't need to dislike. Sometimes I do realize it might have a much bigger effect on someone else. So I do need to start controlling my emotions. But then again, we go back to our tagline, which is passioneering. Mm. Passioneering comes from the word passion. Passion is an emotion. It's an unstable emotion.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
So, that's the drivers. What about the team as a whole? When it's a bad race weekend, what's your processes for debriefing and working out what went wrong?
I think
do you have a blame culture?
I don't think we have a blame culture, because at the end of the day, we still feel we're learning, we're still improving, we're doing well. So we basically try and break it down to go back and look at the fundamentals. Maybe if I'm in a raw emotion, I tend to step away from the briefing. I know I'm not going to be contributing anything useful at that point in time. It's just going to be raw anger.
Now that's interesting, because we spoke with Johnny Wilkinson, the Rugby World Cup winner, and he said, ask yourself in life, not does this make me happy or unhappy, ask yourself, is this helpful or unhelpful? And you've obviously realised that it might make you feel better to shout at people, but maybe it's not helpful. It's just noise.
Yes, and I think at some point in time, as you rightly say, we confuse noise with action. And stuff like that. And I'm trust you, I'll stand up, I raise my hands. I've done a lot of noise. And I don't think that's something which I'm going to change, because that's who I am. Yeah. That's what I believe
in. So if you removed the negative emotion, you would be removing the positive emotion as well. Because I watch the Formula E coverage and I see you in the back of the garage. You respond to every moment. You're delighted when things go well. You look devastated when things go badly. But it's important for you, is it, to keep that emotional connection to what you're doing?
Yes, I think that's what gets you out of the bed in the morning, right? If it's like, if my heartbeat was like, the tolerance was just like two beats up or down, for me, that's close to flat. Yeah, it has to have its peaks and spikes and thing. And that's where I believe. And I think that's something which I also encourage folks to come and, okay, share your emotion, do what you have to do. But at the end of the day, learn the big picture, what we're trying to get to.
But what techniques have you learned that allow you to experience the emotion and then gain perspective quickly? Because I can imagine that your team needs you to still be far-sighted and not make decisions in haste because you're feeling that emotion. So how have you learned to flush it and then get back into that logical, engineering, technical mindset that served you so well?
I think now, with having my core team with me for the last couple of years, they know it's Dilbagh being Dilbagh. Okay, this part of it can be ignored. Okay, he's like having a thing moment. He needs to vent it out. He's 10 minutes later, he's going to be okay. So I think to a certain extent, they've also reached a stage where we'll just sort of let me sort of vent it out, because they know it's going just going to get easier after that. So I think people also, you tend to get to know the other person, okay, when it's a bad moment, when it needs to be stepping in. It's not that we've just sort of come together right now. It's been built over a period of time. So I think you just recognize the other person, where his strengths are, where his weaknesses are, and then you work around that.
I've heard about this with some teams where they've had people that sometimes in meetings they just let you speak, and the rule is that nobody else can respond. You just get to speak, and you can be emotional, you can be angry, you can respond in any way you like, but the rule is that nobody's allowed to interrupt you, but equally nobody's allowed to take what you say personally. And then when you've exhausted yourself, they then said, now what do you want us to do differently with this? Is that the kind of approach that you're describing your team take with you? They just give you 10 minutes and then you come back and they know that they'll get something they can action.
See, a lot of time under this heat of emotion, it's not me who needs to make a decision. I'm trying to get control of the situation. I obviously am not. That's why my emotion is somewhere there, because I'm not in control at that point of time. If there's something which is really out of control, means you're not prepared for it. And I think preparation is where we spend a lot of time.
That's something that I do want to talk about, because in my line of work as a TV presenter, if someone doesn't do their job right, we might end up with a bad interview or a bad camera shot. Or if the worst happens, we fall off the air. In your team, if someone doesn't do their job right, it can cost the life of a driver, a team member, someone in the crowd that's watching. So what processes do you have in place to keep your people fully plugged into the fact that you are working in a life and death environment? There can be no resting on laurels. There can be no approach that is anything other than 100%. I mean, we talk about it a lot with motorsport, that marginal gains approach to constantly improving.
That again comes back to a work ethic, that people need to realize that their responsibilities. And I think that's a part also where people take pride. And again, go back to where we started, do it right the first time around. So I think that message keeps going down. And I think this is something which I repeat literally every race weekend, saying that, guys, as every one of us, can we remove one mistake this weekend? We have 20 people in the garage. If 20 of us can remove one mistake, we remove 20 mistakes today. So that's the constant phrase. I think on the Saturday morning, I go up and say, in that, like a small little huddle which we have, I say, let's all try and remove one mistake today.
Do you address the team before every race weekend?
Yes, we do have a small huddle on Saturday mornings, yeah, 5 minutes.
And how much of that is practical thoughts about the weekend, and how much of that is your emotion?
I think it's more of, it's literally, by now I'm sure people roll their eyes and say, oh man, I've heard this 46 times already. Okay, so it's basically like, I think it's, yeah, today's an opportunity, we need to go do this, we need to perform, this is what we're trying to do, why we are here, or why do we sacrifice so many days of our lives? This is for this moment. So now let's rise for the moment. And I think that's what we try to do, just build up the emotion, because we know by the time, see, in motorsport, etc., the moment you come to the race, you're actually at your physical tiredness, because you've been building it up for that period of time. And it's been a long day already. The race at 4 o'clock, you've started at maybe 5 in the morning or something like that, preparing the cars, getting stuff done, your practice, if you've had a shunt, rebuilding it. So how do we keep the people up, that saying, okay, now is the moment?
Yep.
So just build them back up, saying, okay, guys, we have 1 hour, let's do our best.
I read that one of your comments about your role was that your job is to deliver three factors for your team: technical skills, financial support, and then the human element of it. In your world, what would you say is the most important of those three?
Well, there's no one. For me, I can take two out of the three. I definitely would say it's human, obviously the first. There's without any doubt, and there's financial. I think, let's be clear, motorsport, there's a direct correlation between financial resource and results. So
does that frustrate you, though?
Not exactly, because I think the tolerance level in the sport we are in, it's not yet making too much of a difference. This championship has been reasonably clever to curb certain areas where costs could have gone out of control. And to a certain extent, I think I would like to say I was one of the people who was able to contribute towards that, because I was the chairman of the Formula Teams Association in season 2. I think the biggest contribution which I could have done at that point in time, which I did, is get everyone to sign up for a common chassis and a common battery over 3 generations.
Yeah.
So at that point in time itself, I realized, okay, wearing the Mahindra hat, and this could go way above where we guys will be able to sustain ourselves. So as long as the competition can be a thing, with our innovation, with our agility, we still can be successful. And that's, I think, has been proven. So we've seen smaller teams in this championship doing really well. We've seen customer teams in motorsport. It's very rare where the customer beats the factory team. We've seen that happening in our championship. And I think, so that's the good part of it, is that when you go into a race weekend, it literally is a championship. And it's not a cliche that all of us go in the weekend believing that we can win.
So are you an optimist? Do you sit here now ahead of a new Formula One season and believe that you can win the championship?
Yes, sir. I do believe it. Otherwise, I won't be here.
So what have you as a family reflected on from last season to do better, to make sure that this year you do win the championship?
See, there's no silver bullets left in motorsport now. Okay, the incremental gains are over. First couple of years, you could see the silver bullets coming in. So just going back to every process, every procedure, how do we incrementally do it better? There are small areas which you've tried to invest in the recent past, and something which honestly I did not take seriously earlier was mental health. I always was a bit dismissive of it. I thought it was a weakness when people talked about mental health. And now we see, okay, in terms of, when I say just sports psychology, we send our drivers down. And each of them are experienced drivers, but I mandated, you guys, you are going to be spending some time with a sports psychologist. It makes a difference. Mm-hmm. And those little bits.
What changed your mind on that? Because going back 5, 10, 15, 20 years, it wasn't an uncommon opinion to think that mental health problems were a weakness. What changed that opinion for you?
I think it was a selfish reason. When you could see that, okay, that could give me that one small little gain in performance when people have spoken about their experiences. Mm-hmm. And this is again something which Nick came to me. Nick said, okay, I was having a bad time in some part of his career, and I went and spoke to Dr. Dieter Hackforth in Munich. I've spent some time with him, and says that made a change. And he says, I would encourage you to try it. So I think it was, again, trying to look for that every little bit as a difference. All of us have a comfort zone, and I think we have to get out of it to start performing. And because the moment you sit in your comfort zone, you're not progressing.
Well, that to me is an interesting question about you, because looking at the pattern of your career, that you have broken out of industries and gone into new worlds, and then given your experience in racing, what's next for you?
I don't know. I really don't know. And I've never planned my career forward. That's why it sort of zigs and zags the way it goes. And I think that's why I like it. The philosophy for me has been maximized today.
I've loved sitting and having this conversation with you. I think it's been so interesting. I think you've been so eloquent, and I've picked up loads of interesting insights. There's a couple of things that I just want to mention. We spoke at the beginning about how your parents had a very strict idea of how education is the most important thing for you, and you have shown that there is another path for you. So how are you with your own children? How obsessed are you about their education, or are you spending your time encouraging them to just follow a path of emotion, which I get the sense is what you've done?
I'm going to tell you something which I don't think I've told anyone yet, okay? I don't know what I'm going to do next, but I would love to become a teacher.
Really?
Okay. A middle school teacher. Because that's something which is a passion for me and which I would love to do at some point in time in my life. Going back to it. For me, I think education is broken. Because when I say we, means at my age and people that I think, when we went to learn answers. We memorized answers. I think education needs to change to ask questions. Because really? Answers are available today. It's experiences which can help you ask better questions. And I keep telling my daughter, please ask better questions. Like learn to ask questions. The answer's available. With all the tools out there, your internets, your Googles and stuff like that, you have all the answers out there in the world. Learn how to ask the question.
What would have been a better question we could have asked you then?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
Brilliant. I've really enjoyed it. You mentioned that in your head you're doing this for India. I think it's very brave, because you could be doing it for India, but you could be doing it quietly in a laboratory somewhere away from the glare of the public, yet you very publicly have a team called Mahindra, named after a huge Indian company, and you're there on the television every week fronting up and doing it for India. So congratulations for being brave enough to do it.
I don't know if it's brave or foolish, but there's a fine line out there. But in the end, I think it's been a great journey in the end. And I really need to thank the fans in India, people who supported us, like believed in us, sent constant messages of support. It's just amazing.
So we now do a quick fire round where we just ask you some questions. And the first one is, what are the three non-negotiable behaviors that you and the people around you must buy into?
Integrity. I think that's for me the most important thing is integrity. The second thing is going back to my thing, do it right the first time around. That's really important for me. And the third bit is, I think, just honesty. I think those are the three non-negotiable bits for me.
What advice would you give a teenage dillbag just starting out?
Don't take yourself so seriously. I think sometimes with education we take it so seriously. And I hope my daughter's not listening to me, because that's something different to say at home. Yeah. But I think it's like, you know, take the experience rather than the content. Yeah.
How important is legacy to you?
Legacy is very important to me. I think we don't give due respect to legacy in our lives. And I think, especially in today's world, and now I'm going to be sounding like the 50-year-old that I am, is that our attention spans are so short, and it is for this instant gratification that we want something, we forget legacy, we forget how the, like, whatever has happened in the last has helped us get to where we are at this point in time. It could be in sport, etc. And we cannot forget it, and we should not forget it.
And the final question, what is your one golden rule to living a high-performance life?
For me, is my philosophy is maximize today.
Maximize today. Brilliant. We will allow you to leave and go and maximize the rest of your day. Thank you so much for taking the time. I mean, I've picked out lots of little things from that. I love your bit about learn to ask questions. Don't just learn answers. And I think take the experience from life, not just the content. I think that is a key.
Thanks, guys, for having me over. I really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward. Today is going to be an exciting day because I'm going to be driving a Formula E car later this afternoon. Okay? And I'm going to thoroughly embarrass myself. No problem. Let's go do it.
Good luck.
Brilliant. Thanks, guys.
And good luck for the season ahead. Damien.
Jake.
What a humble man.
Wasn't he brilliant? Yeah, I loved him.
I love the bit about education is broken. Spend your life learning to ask questions, not learning answers. I think that is turning education on its head. And he's probably absolutely right, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely. I think it fitted with his philosophy of question everything. You know, he said that the most dangerous words in the English language are, we've always done it that way. And I think when you come at it with the idea of asking questions and knowing what you don't know and being comfortable with that, I think that becomes a superpower in its own right, because it allows you to ask difficult questions or challenge convention, which is what he's done throughout his whole career.
I remember when I first was offered the job as the Formula One presenter for the BBC, and I went into a meeting, and it was in the boardroom at the BBC, which was in the old television centre building. And I remember I was got stuck in traffic and I was late, which was massively embarrassing because it was the first meeting when we all got together. And there was like Martin Brundle, you know, multiple award-winning broadcaster. And there was David Coulthard, multiple Formula One winner. Eddie Jordan, multiple millionaire, my big boss of the BBC program and the editor and loads of other people. And I hardly spoke because I was so aware that in that company, I hardly knew anything. And I was reminded as I walked in about that old phrase of better to be considered an idiot than open your mouth and have it confirmed.
Yeah.
And I remember being late and going, and opening the door to the room. And the program editor was a good friend of my agent at the time. And a few days later, he rang my agent and said, I'm worried about Jake and whether he's right for the Formula One job because he didn't speak in the meeting. Only now do I think that was such a smart move to just sit there and be quiet.
Yep.
A bit like he spoke about today, because I didn't, without really realizing it, I think I knew what I didn't know.
Yep.
And I didn't know bloody loads.
Yep.
Everything.
Well, this comes back to, we've spoke about this a number of times on the podcast, is the Dunning-Kruger law. The Dunning-Kruger law is what trips so many people up, that we can watch our politicians on television and we say, oh, you know, I could do a better job than that. And yet the Dunning-Kruger law says we don't know what we don't know. We don't know the complexity, the intricacies, the difficulties of what they're trying to balance. So we're at peak ignorance at the start of it, yeah. Whereas once we exist in that
world, you don't realize you're ignorant because you don't realize you don't know.
Yeah, exactly. The example I often use to illustrate it is, if you think of the early stages of talent shows on TV, where the bit we all love is when the idiots show up and somebody says, I'm going to sing like Mariah Carey, then sounds like a cat being strangled. Yeah. That's funny because they don't know how bad they are, but equally they don't realize just how far away from Mariah Carey they are. And I think what Dilbag gave us there is that humility to go into any situation and just be comfortable not knowing, but then asking questions to learn and accelerate the process quickly.
And I think also he knows he's flawed when it comes to emotion, because he has to take himself away. Like, almost the big moment where you need your leaders is when something goes wrong. And from talking to him, that's almost the very moment he steps away, because he knows that he has to take a breath, and the team kind of understand that. I struggle with whether being that emotional is a good or a bad thing.
Yeah, again, I'd go back and I'd ask what we should now call the Johnny Wilkinson question of, is it helpful or unhelpful? And I think what he's recognising is that he almost needs to do it so it's helpful for him, but it's not helpful for his team. So he has a plan in place that they don't rely on him in those moments.
Interesting stuff. Thanks for your time.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you.
Well, Damien, it was great to sit down and have that conversation with Dilbag. And I think people are going to really get a lot from that conversation because he's someone who, he's a bit of a chameleon in many ways. He kind of has moved around, done all kinds of different things, but done all of them with passion at the very centre of it. And often we speak to people when they ask us about how they can have more happiness, how they can feel fulfilment, how they can be successful. Finding something you're passionate about seems to be a pretty good response, doesn't it?
Definitely. I think what Dilbag was a great example of was the power of humility. You know, humility, if we think of it in three stages, Jake, the first stage is we have to get beyond peak idiot stage. We have to know what we don't know and get beyond that. And we enter that valley of humility where we're curious, we ask questions, we try and explore the craft and how it works before we arrive at the third stage, which is the hill of knowledge. And I think Dilbag is somebody that has entered the valley of humility in so many industries, whether this is in computers, whether it's now in Formula E. He's a guy that comes at everything by seeking understanding, asking questions, being open. And I think he was a perfect example of that even when we sat down with him. So I regarded it as a real treat.
I loved it. And I hope you do at home as well. We would love actually to know what you think of it. So while you're listening to this, please feel free to hop onto wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review the pod. Just let us know what you thought of the conversation that we had with Dilbag. I thought he was a really inspiring guy. Thanks to you for downloading, supporting and listening. Check us out at High Performance on Instagram. And we'll see you very soon for another episode of the High Performance Podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.